Welcome to our last call out of four for support. And at this time, there has only been one question submitted, and it was actually submitted as a follow-up from last week's call. And it's submitted by Jaquetta. Jaquetta, are you here?
I am.
Okay. First of all, for those of you, some of you were on live last week, some of you listened to the recording afterwards. It was a pretty heavy call, looking into death, and you know, I laugh nervously. Like, what was that like for you, Jaquetta? And after having let it settle, I mean, we were basically exploring fear of death, fear of death, fear of the dying process, all of that. I mean, it was a pretty intense hour, and I want to know where you landed after a week off and letting this settle, if you want to talk about it.
Where I've landed is okay. What I went through that night, driving from Breckenridge to Denver in a snowstorm and the next day flying back home, was really intense and more than a little difficult. Where I am now is I'm much better with the idea of being dead. I don't like it anymore. I still am, I have connection to the idea of being Jaquetta, and I have connection with the idea of being Jaquetta now, and a sense of, gee, I missed all those years. And I'm still scared of the process of dying. But I also recognize the futility of worrying about that. It's still there, but it has calmed a good bit.
Okay. Why would you say that having gone through this, that has in any way affected how much more calm you feel? Or I don't know if you feel, you said quite a bit or just a bit. You know, I guess what I'm trying to gather is, was this helpful?
Yes, it was. And the reason, if that's where we're going, is I had to spend some time with it. And it's, you're either spending time with things or you're rejecting them or you're repressing them. And if you spend time with it, I spent time with it. It was not comfortable by a long shot. I did a lot of crying. But I came out on the other side a little better. I'm not all happy about dying. But it had gotten to a place that was just like really freaky, and it's less freaky for sure.
Okay. You know, Zen is about spending some time with whatever it is that we're going through, spending some quality time. In my case, my work that I offer people, shadow work, is looking at the things that you normally don't want to look at, looking at your fear, looking at your pain, you know, spending some time with it, learning from it. You know, what is the opportunity that's found in this fear, this pain, this discomfort? And ultimately, that's, you know, it's part of Zen practice. It's not the entirety of Zen practice. It's more like the shadow part of Zen practice. You know, Zen practice is really ultimately waking up and realizing your own delusion. You know, if there was a goal in Zen, that would be the goal. And that's why all Zen masters at the end of their lives, when you ask them, what did you learn? They usually have some sort of reference to that. Like, oh, I've just been, my life has just been one terrible decision after the next. I've learned absolutely nothing, you know. I've learned how delusional I am, all of that. And, you know, the story that I told last week about the master, you know, screaming, begging for his life while he was being murdered, it was, you know, really true that you could literally meditate in a monastery and become a Zen monk, a Zen priest, a Zen Roshi, and you're still going to be afraid of death. You know, that doesn't go away. That's just, but you're going to really merge with it. You're going to become one with it. You're going to spend some time with it. You know, these monks meditating in a monastery, they're there for 20, 30, 50 years. You got to think that they're getting pretty bored, right? But you introduce fear of death in later years of their lives, they're not bored anymore. You know, to just kind of meditate on this, contemplate this, spend some time with it, it becomes their new teacher. And so in many ways, that's what's happened for you, Chiquetta. Maybe this has become your new teacher. And the ultimate teacher, I believe, is always our fears, our greatest fears. You know, what is jumping up and down trying to get your attention? And so I want to pause here, too, before we get to the only question that was submitted this week, which is how do I evaluate the quality of my finite life, which you also submitted, Chiquetta. Like, while I'm still here, you know, how do I evaluate the quality of my life? I want to leave that question towards the end. And I want to open up, first of all, the doors for other people to talk about their fear of death or death itself, or fear in general, or submit in person right now any other questions that you didn't have a chance to submit via email before we get to this one final, it's kind of finale question that I think is a really gorgeous question. So I'm going to open up the door right now for anybody to say anything they want or ask anything they want.
I have one.
Okay.
This is Kelly. And it kind of maybe does tie into the fear of death as well. So I struggle with the four-step method when I think my fear is unreasonable or irrational. So if it's something that makes perfect sense that I should be afraid of it, then I find it very easy to go through the four steps and, you know, take my fear for a ski or however it turns out. But when I think that I should not be afraid of something because it doesn't make sense, then I end up just getting really mad at myself.
Give me an example of something that you figure to be unreasonable or irrational.
So I am afraid when I'm skiing of getting hit by somebody, which in and of itself is not irrational, but the fear extends to if anybody comes within 20 or 30 feet of me, I get, you know, an adrenaline spike and I get scared and nervous and have to pull over. So that part to me is irrational.
What this is, I love to personify fear. Like, imagine that fear is afraid that you're going to get hit by somebody while skiing. Of course, mm-hmm. It's irrational fear. Absolutely, this happens. Maybe it's even happened to you, Kelly, before. It certainly happened to me more times than I can count. Mm-hmm. And so it's irrational fear, but then if you just block it out while you're skiing, then over time, what fear does is it has to scream a little louder, or not scream a little louder, because maybe it hasn't screamed at all. But just say it a little bit louder. You continue to ignore it, then it says it even louder. And then eventually, over time, it screams. That's one possible explanation for why it just seems to be excessive and weird. The other reason why it might be excessive and weird is if there's another area of your life that you've been ignoring fear, and this seems to be the only time that fear can get your attention. So it's redirected and showing up in your life in another way. Like, maybe you feel like semi-abused by somebody in your life, you know, that they have been physically abusive or something, and you've just ignored that fear in your home life, but then you go skiing and the fear of being abused by an out-of-control skier, it shows up in an exaggerated way. Mm-hmm. So one of these two things is probably happening. Which do you think is the case with you? And I can repeat them again if you want.
I think it's probably the latter. I think it actually might be both.
Okay. All right. What I would do in a situation like that then, where it seems like, boy, I certainly jumped kind of, it almost like it's a PTSD reaction. Like there's some sort of like trauma, you know, that may be going on. So that's the second one. Mm-hmm. Or it's just trying to, and it may be a combination of both too, you know, like we don't really even need to evaluate why. What we need to do is just spend some time with the feeling. And then I think that it'll become more and more revealed.
Okay.
Let's go through the four-step method, and maybe we'll do some voice dialogue around this, but let's just see what we come up with. So close your eyes, and maybe everyone can get on board with this and think about a fear that is unreasonable or irrational in your own life, maybe not getting hit by skiing, but just something else. Maybe even write it down so you can remind yourself what it is. And let's go through this together. But Kelly, I'm going to put you in the hot seat.
Okay.
So I want you to first acknowledge, yes, it's normal and natural to be afraid of getting hit by somebody while you're skiing, but it's also normal and natural to have unreasonable or irrational fear show up in your life if you've been ignoring fear.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a modification of the first part, the first step. You know, it's not that unreasonable or irrational fear is normal and natural, but it's normal and natural to show up if you've been ignoring fear or if you have a long history of ignoring fear. Do you follow?
Yeah.
All right. Step two, I want you to find this fear of getting hit by somebody while skiing in your body right now. And sometimes it helps to just imagine, you know, what it was like the last time you went skiing and somebody came a little too close and that feeling that you felt and exaggerate it. You don't necessarily need to do this all the time, but if you can't find it right now, that is a trick that you can pull. But mm-hmm. just find that unreasonable, irrational fear of getting hit by somebody while skiing in your body right now and tell me where it is that you feel it. And give it a name, too. What does it feel like?
It's tightness in my throat and prickliness on my skin, mainly my arms and my back.
Okay. On arms and back. I'm writing this down. Does it have a name? Does it feel like panic? Does it feel like anger? You know, what does it feel like? Can you give it a name?
It doesn't feel like anger. It feels more like panic.
Okay. Panic. With me, because I have this as well, when somebody comes too close, I kind of scream, and it almost feels like I'm angry at them for violating my space. And right there, I can already have an insight that any time anyone has ever violated my space in the history of my life, you know, when somebody gets too close to me, when it's unwelcomed, you know, that's where I go to. I almost go to more like a combative, aggressive, you know, F you anger state. So sometimes it's, you know, what I'm doing is kind of more an advanced version of the four-step method that I would do after having done this for a really long time. So already I am getting insights in my own experience of how I, when I'm out skiing, why this triggers me as well. Because I have the same response to somebody that gets too close to me. You know, I've had 9 knee surgeries, et cetera, et cetera. So we're in our heads now, but is there any insight that you're getting even from step two about where you're feeling it, the prickliness in your arms and back? Does this sound familiar? Is there this tightness in your throat that you felt other times in your life, not just while skiing?
Yeah.
Anything you want to share?
I have to think about it because I think the skiing thing is so much in the forefront that's where it all comes out the most. But I feel it when I think about death. When I listen to the last call, and I feel that same feeling.
Right. I mean, it's going to be showing up for everybody. For me, like I mentioned, it's showing up as redirected fear. You know, my overreaction is somebody coming too close to me while skiing, which actually happened on Saturday twice. Same guy, different runs. It was bizarre. It's redirected fear that I have actually towards my husband, I realize. So just notice that there's going to be some similarities to this feeling on the ski mountain to something in your life, seemingly unrelated. Maybe you're not dealing with that. You know, I'm not dealing with my fear and anger towards my husband, and so it's showing up with an overreaction on the mountain. So step three, are you in resistance to this feeling? Are you ignoring it? You know, that's usually my form of resistance. Other people make themselves so busy they don't have to feel it. Some people repress it. Like, resistance comes in many forms. what is your reaction to it? How do you deal with it?
Right now,
hold on, let me just stop for 1 second. Mm-hmm. Not how do you deal with that fear while skiing. How do you deal with the feeling in your body that is now showing up that is unrelated, like we're not out skiing while we're doing this, right? Just sitting here on the phone with me, how do you deal with that feeling, that sensation that comes from the skiing but is now isolated in your body?
Sitting here right now, I feel accepting of it. I don't feel like I'm resisting it. It's just there. It's neutral.
All right. Accepting can be very passive. It can be like it is what it is. Is that what it's showing up for you as?
I think so.
Nothing I can do about it? Okay. So if fear is listening, which I think he is, and you're saying, okay, he's your roommate, has something to say, he's gotten to be a little obnoxious, irrational, unreasonable, kind of crazy, and you're like, well, it is what it is. I'm accepting of that.
Mm-hmm.
What is that relationship that you have with your roommate called fear?
It's not good. There's a wall there, and I'm not really in tune with my roommate. It's like I'm still, even though I think I'm not trying to block, I still am trying to block.
Right. It's like, oh, I'm accepting it. Like, it seems like, yeah, I'm a good person. I'm accepting who they are. They suck. You know, he's a total asshole, but I accept him. It's like, I'm not buying it. Nobody's buying it, you know. So there's still a wall, to borrow your words there. You're not really willing to spend some quality time with this entity. And so it's a very passive thing to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can you have a more progressive approach to this feeling? You know, that's the koan, that's the riddle that gets introduced in step 3. So then step 4, what do we spend our time with? You know, we could spend some time feeling the feeling. We could spend some time in the voice of acceptance. We could spend some time feeling what it feels like to have a wall up against this feeling. You know, there's a lot of things that we can do in step 4, and the question always is, which is jumping up and down on its head trying to get your attention? Like, which is the most interesting part of the conversation we've had so far?
Listening to the roommate.
Right.
Spending time with the roommate.
So then spend some time, and we can do this as a voice dialogue. Like, I could speak to the voice of tightness in your throat, prickliness in arms and back, or the voice of panic, and you could speak as that voice, and I could have a conversation with that voice, you know, how does Kelly feel about you? And I think we have a general sense of what that conversation would be like. But because mm-hmm. this is the 4-step method, and we still keep some separation between you and the feeling, and it's you having a relationship with it, I recommend that we just spend some time feeling it. So let's take a minute right now to just go there and go back to that step 2, that tightness in your throat, prickliness in the arms and back, a feeling of panic. You know, wherever you feel it, whatever it is, I just want you to spend some quality time with it right now without trying to get rid of it. We'll do it for 1 minute. Mostly in silence. If I have something to say, I may chime in. But let's just do that now, collectively in silence, and feel our fear, our panic, without trying to get rid of it. A deeper step that can happen now is, what is the feeling beneath that feeling? Instead of using your mind to look for the answer, just go ahead and feel it now. Let the answer come to you. And tell me, what did you find?
Heaviness.
And where's the heaviness? In what part of your body? Is it showing up emotionally or another way?
It's showing up physically. Kind of, I think, in my core. It's sort of underlying.
Okay. Does it feel emotional?
No, I think it feels physical.
Why is it trying to get your attention?
I think it's like almost a message about being able to do this work and not feeling so heavy.
Say more.
It's letting me know that it's possible for it not to be there. If I can spend quality time with these physical feelings, it's like it's trying to send me a message that I won't feel heavy.
So maybe the fear is the bridge that you ride to get to the heaviness that's trying to get your attention. That's really what's down deeper. You know, I created this PTSD course, and I really dug deep to create it. It's an online course, and it's like, what? You know, I've had PTSD, but it hasn't been really strong, and I talked to a bunch of soldiers that had it in horrible form. And it's like, what is going on for these folks? And what I found is that there's the resistance, you know, which is the awful feeling that's at the core of, I don't want to feel this, I don't want to be this way, I don't want to have this problem, you know, whatever the symptoms are. And then there's the fear beneath the resistance that once you get the resistance sorted, then you have access to. And then you spend some time with the fear, and once that gets sorted, you know, what's beneath that? You know, that's where the real world work gets done. And, you know, what came up for me when we just spent that first minute feeling the fear, you know, I like I said, I feel it too. I just got cut off on Saturday twice by the same guy in two different runs. I think he was doing it on purpose, you know, is that I came up with like this heavy hatred of other people, that they invade my life, that they cause problems for me, that obviously has been around since my childhood. You know, my false self persona says, you know, one of my sentences was, I hate other people, the world is a fucked up place. It's like, okay, yes, fear while skiing is interesting, but you get down beneath the layers, and this is what I should be looking at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my contempt for other people from my childhood. So what is the layer beneath the layer beneath the layer beneath, you know, here we go, down to the heart of this artichoke, and what do we find there by using this process? Can you now spend some time with it? And that is your practice. That's where these four steps lead you. So last thing we can do, or do you have any questions before I kind of have you do the step four with your heaviness?
No, thank you. I don't.
All right, and there may be a resistance to this practice, too, that may be in there somewhere. I'm not sure. But
the deepest, possible.
Yeah. And if so, you can use the four steps for that. Like, you know, the four steps were designed to help people deal with their fear, but what has come out is that it's for us to deal, because fear is such a huge part of everything. I mean, even when I say my contempt for other people, it's also my fear of them. You know, like it's the ingredient in what the deepest, darkest, you know, most bottom layer is going to be fear. Fear is going to be part of that as well. So right now what I want you to do, this is how you can go all the way with the practice this round, is spend some time in silence just feeling that physical heaviness in your core without trying to get rid of it. Give that child your undivided attention for 1 minute. The bonus step of the four-step art of fear method is, what is the lesson here? Like, what is this part of me trying to convey? And I feel like this actually ties us into how do I evaluate the quality of my finite life, because I really feel like this piece, for me at least, of my contempt towards other people is something that I really need to do some work on. It's jumping up and down trying to get my attention. And this guy that cut me off twice on Saturday, it's like he's my teacher. He's like, hey, you better look at this. Hey, you better look at this. But what is it that I'm supposed to be looking at? Well, the four steps kind of take you there. If you're paying attention, what do you feel? It's in your body. Your body doesn't lie. So, Kelly, what was that like for you?
It feels good. Good is probably not quite the right word. It feels healing. It feels healing to sit with that.
Yeah. It's like a massage therapist that's massaging you, and all of a sudden they get right down to the spot that's just a knot. And then you spend some time just giving it some love, you know, it releases and feels healing. So good job. Anybody else have anything to share about what we just did or any questions? Kelly, you too, if you have any clarifying questions.
I don't have any questions. That was very helpful. Thank you.
Anyone else? Any other questions unrelated to what we just explored or unrelated to Jaquetta's question, which is coming up? So in conclusion, there is no right way to do the four-step art of fear method. And yet there is a wrong way to do it. I know that sounds funny, but the wrong way is to just be in your head the whole time. But if you can recognize that you're in your head, you can use the four-step art of fear method to go there too. It's like normal and natural to be monkey mind. Okay, what am I feeling? I can't feel anything. All I can do is be in my mind. Am I in resistance to my mind? Well, fighting a war against fear will cause it to persist. Fighting a war against your mind will also cause it to persist. And then address the resistance if you need to, or then spend some quality time with your just crazy monkey mind. So you can do the four-step art of fear method regarding your mind, your brain, the thinking mind, the judging mind, you name it. This was originally designed to take us into our body and feel our emotions, but it can be packaged for that purpose. But if you want to do it to deal with an emotional problem, then the right way to do it is to just pay attention to your body and spend some quality time just feeling whatever it is that you're feeling. And if it's the resistance that you're feeling, so be it. But just be present when you do it, pay attention, and you will find what you're looking for. Moving on, Jaquetta, you there still?
Yes, I am.
So in our last half an hour, we're going to go back to your question. How do I evaluate the quality of my finite life? I love that you put the word finite in there. And I saw a cartoon once, a teacher that was teaching a class of, looked to be about fifth graders. She had the words birth and then dash, in between stuff, and then dash, death, right? Birth, and then there's death, and then there's that in-between stuff. So how do you evaluate the quality of your in-between stuff, right? Why did you ask this question?
Because it seems, well, it feels important to looking at the fact that I'm going to die. We all know we're going to. And for me, and I think this might be common, I'm not going to die yet, and you kind of push it away. And at the same time, it's like you're not really looking at your life. And when I forced the question, looking at death, and I'm not trying to mitigate the situation, but I want to feel better about it. And it's like, what is all this? How has this time been spent? Or does it matter?
Mm-hmm.
I think it matters. I think it does. Maybe it doesn't.
If you were to ask a Zen master one day, does it matter to ask the ultimate question, you know, meaning of life? He would say, yes, definitely it matters, one day. And if you ask the same question to the Zen master the next day, he would say, no, it definitely does not matter. You know, Zen masters are weird like that. And, you know, you could evaluate that a couple ways. It matters and it doesn't matter. Or maybe it matters some days, but it doesn't matter the next day. Or maybe the Zen master is making a mockery of the question. I don't know. But I do know that I have kind of two moms, my birth mom and then also my surrogate mom that I spent a lot of time with. I met her when I was 19 years old. And I've watched both these women get to the point where they're close to death. And I have never been one to shy away from the death conversation. Like, I've actually asked my mom, you know, are you afraid of dying? You know, how do you feel about death? Do you feel like you're satisfied with your life? You know, is there anything that you want me to know before you die? What kind of funeral do you want to have? Like, I don't know how many people have that conversation, but I know that it's being encouraged quite a bit. It hasn't gotten its 15 minutes of fame quite yet, but there are some families that are having that conversation. And there are other families that would never. And what's been interesting in talking to these two women about their looming death is I've seen a pattern where, especially my surrogate mom, doesn't want to die, looked terrified at the mere mention of death, started eating extremely healthy to try and ward off death, exercising regularly because she wanted to die on her own terms. And then all of a sudden one day it shifted where she became no longer afraid to die. And then it shifted again, and she's, mind you, not depressed, where she's now excited to die. And my mother's the same. She's not depressed. She's not afraid to die. She's not quite excited to die yet. But she's just kind of over it, you know. So what tends to happen, and I'm just kind of prefacing this whole conversation with this, is that as we age, especially as our bodies start disintegrating, you know, you kind of get tired and things start to hurt and a lot of your friends are dying. It's kind of like the perfect situation by which a lot of people are okay with dying. And those of you that have worked with me before have heard me talk about this study done in hospice where the people that were in resistance to dying feel like they hadn't really lived. But the people that were okay with dying or embracing it felt like they had really lived. And so maybe these two women in my life feel like they really lived, you know, which is interesting because my mom, you know, she had a career that she liked, had a terrible marriage. Her whole life was about her kids, really. And she really feels like that was her reason for being, you know, to have her kids, raise her kids. So this is all a roundabout way of saying that, Jaquetta, you're right on track. You know, right now at age 60, you are supposed to be afraid of dying. It's like, oh my gosh, it's like I need to do an inventory of my life. You know, that's why we have bucket lists. That's why we have these things that's why we kind of start a career in midlife or start a new career at age 60. I haven't done enough with my life. I don't want to have any regrets on my deathbed. You know, time is running out. I need to get a knee replacement and go skiing more. So putting that all into the soup bowl, you know, where do we go with this? Do you have any comments about what I've outlined, Jaquetta?
No, this seems like a pretty good pass so far.
I feel pretty qualified to talk about this subject too because I've done so many death practices. And what a death practice is where in a personal growth workshop, you know, certainly in all my ski to live camps now, I've done easily 70 runs like this. We ski in the voice of, you know, 3 hours to live. And this is the last run of your life. I've stayed up all night with a group of people reading out loud the Tibetan book of living and dying to each other with a microphone. Like I've done a lot of 24-hour to die death practices alone in the desert. Writing letters to everyone that matters, things like that. You know, death practice looks very different every time you do it. But so I've spent a lot of time contemplating this. And the answer to your question, how do you evaluate the quality of my finite life after all this, is in the words of James Frey, the meaning of life is whatever you want it to be, right? But I have come up with my own understanding of what the own meaning of life to me is and how I evaluate the quality of my own life, which I'll share with you. And I want everybody to be thinking about this and what, you know, if you want to share what your meaning of life is or how you evaluate the quality of your life with a group, that is definitely an opportunity. For sure, Jaquetta, I'm going to ask you to do this. But I actually judge the quality of my life by the moments of spiritual ecstasis I have in any given year. And what that looks like is, we call it flow, zone, higher altered states, big mind, no mind, true self, silence, the pause between the ohms, the ohm itself, like many, many different names. Every spiritual tradition has a name for this, and I'm calling it spiritual ecstasis. And I feel this at Burning Man, not all the time, but maybe 3 or 4 times in the 12 days I spend there. I feel this when I ski a really scary run, heli-skiing in Alaska. I feel this when I pet my cat when we're really connected. Sports is probably the most oft way that I have felt this in my life, especially doing a sport really, really well, while doing it on in a scary way, like I just mentioned in Alaska. So that's how I evaluate the quality of my finite life. Jaquetta, you want to acknowledge maybe what yours might be, or maybe you don't know. I don't know.
I definitely feel it when I'm skiing. I have felt it when I am in groups of important people at moments of crescendo. It's hard to describe what that is. When something in that group, when we're doing something together, hits a zenith. Burning Man certainly had some high moments out there. I've had these things alone.
Is that how you judge the quality of your life, though? I mean, that's my answer. Is that your answer?
I agree that this is a commonplace for me. That is your answer. It's also mine. There's some open-ended thing, and I think I don't know what I want. To peg it
on. Say more.
Maybe afraid of dying before I know. Which I think is tied to a late, if you will, realization of appreciation of life.
Maybe the meaning of your life is to find a way to appreciate life.
That's a little off, but
okay. You know, let me throw out a few other options. You've heard me say this before. The meaning of life is to have arms and legs and heart and brain and be able to feel and taste and have the senses. And for me, the meaning of life is to experience pleasure. And then I go on to say the greatest pleasure we have is learning and growing. So breaking it down, the meaning of life is to learn and grow, experience things. You know, have I learned something new today? Have I learned something new this year? Have I learned what I was supposed to learn in this incarnation, if you believe in reincarnation? You know, did I grow as a person? You know, this is a question that we can ask ourselves on our deathbed, or did I just submit to reacting to life and to my own delusion? My new favorite one, well, another one of my favorites is the meaning of life is to work and to love. It ties a little bit into what I just said, you know, to experience pleasure. Love is pleasure. And then the work kind of fits into Picasso, which is kind of my new favorite. The meaning of life is to find your gift. The purpose of life is to give it away. That's a quote by him. The meaning of life is to find your gift. The purpose of life is to give it away. Work, you know, love and work. And I really feel like I found great meaning and purpose in being a voice dialogue facilitator and helping people with fear. And figuring this whole fear thing out, you know, which just I feel like the universe has groomed me to figure out, you know, that for me may even top me judging the quality of my life by the moments of spiritual stasis. You know, I judge the quality of my life by how successful I've been at finding my gifts and to offer them to the planet, to the world. So just those are my personal, like, oh, you know, pause moments. And so back to you, Jaquetta. And then after you, Jaquetta, everyone else, anyone else actually who wants to speak, you know, what is yours? What's striking you? The ultimate Zen question I say all the time is, who am I? Who am I? Who am I? We ask it all the time, and there is no answer because we're constantly changing. And maybe another ultimate Zen question is, what is the meaning of life? What is the meaning of life? What is the meaning of life? And we keep asking it, and it's the ultimate Zen question because there is no answer. And just we find meaning and purpose just by asking the question, because it gives us a moment of presence and consideration, possible insight. And then we ask you again tomorrow, and the answer is completely different. I don't know. Who wants to comment on all this, or maybe answer the question today? What is the meaning of life for me today?
It's Freud who said, the meaning of life is to love and to work.
Ah, thank you.
And, you know, I want shared experience more with other people. It, that thing about it doesn't have to be fun to be fun. The shared experience of two or more people, it can be two or it can be ten, involved and engaged completely in doing something, whether it's skiing or building a fence, is if it's really shared, and not just 10 people doing the same thing, but if you're connected in that experience, it's a great thing. It can be skiing, it can be a bike ride, it can be a camping trip, it can be trying to put up a tent at Burning Man and shit's falling apart. There's something really wonderful in that. And I've had that a few times, and it's not enough right now. I need more of it. Very clear.
A man died and was at the pearly gates, and the guy said, well, Joe, you know, it could go either way. Did I tell this story last week? I don't think I did. I just told it recently to somebody. Stop me if I have. And they said, you could either go to heaven or hell. We're undecided. And he's like, well, I want to go to heaven. And well, you might want to check it out first. So you take him to hell. Huge buffet, every single food ever created, just most luscious buffet, you know, big giant dinner party going on. And everybody's sitting around, this is hell. He's like, well, that doesn't look so bad. But then he notices that they all have 4-foot-long forks, and they can't eat the food because they can get it on the fork, no problem, but they can't get it to their mouth. So then the guy takes them up to heaven, same situation, big buffet, this huge table. Not buffet is the wrong word, just big dinner party. And same forks, but everybody up in heaven was scooping up the food and feeding it to each other. And so that's heaven, where we take care of each other, or where we're kind of working with each other, just like you outlined. And hell is where you're just trying to feed yourself. So I like that. And I had a convenient story for it, right? Who else wants to talk about the quality of your finite life? Like, what makes you feel like your life has been quality? Anyone else?
When I help people. Like if I know I've really helped somebody. I think that's one of the ways that I judge mine.
You know, I have to say it because it makes me laugh when this happens, but we were talking about skiing before. I've taken to just, you know, when I'm tired skiing, just sitting down in the snow and just watching people. I love it. And inevitably, somebody who really, really loves helping people comes by and says, "Are you okay?" Right? Like they just, it's like they'd rather come over and see if I need help than keep skiing powder. And, you know, the guy that somebody crashes underneath the chairlift and five people ski past him, and then there's the one guy that stops and picks up the ski. It's like he lives for that kind of stuff. That's the highlight of his ski day. And that's, so that's like the meaning and purpose for some people, but not everybody. We're all so different. What else? Let me hear from at least one more person.
A second what Jaquetta said, wanting more experiences, higher experiences.
The spiritual stasis that I mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And they could come from connection with other people, but they don't have to. Could be from connection to the music from a really great DJ at Burning Man, which is kind of a connection to another person. You know, somebody made the music, somebody's playing the music, somebody built the art card that it's playing off of. You know, for some people, the meaning of life is just to survive. Some people, the quality of their life is just how many years they live. So it's different for everyone. And for the people that are on this call who are committed to living the best lives they can possibly live, of course, that's not going to be enough, just surviving. Or surviving, you know, their abusive childhood. Like, that can be part of it, but that's not the ultimate. You know, that might be the meaning of life for an 18-year-old or a 25-year-old or even a 30-year-old. But if we keep up with spiritual or consciousness or psychological practice, you know, we keep asking the question, what is it now? Well, what about now? So the meaning of life is whatever you want it to be, in the words of James Frey, or whatever just seems like quality right now. Like, you know it when you feel it. But your question, Jaquetta, was how do I evaluate the quality of my finite life? So taking it back to kind of the, because I know that you put a lot of time into phrasing the question just so. I want to address your desire to evaluate it, because I know you, you're in your head a lot. And I would not be a Zen student and a Zen facilitator if I didn't bring it back to Zen, okay? So I want to do a couple voices with you, but Jaquetta, you're back in the hot seat. Why did you ask it that way? How do I evaluate? You know, I'm a voice dialogue facilitator. I really pay attention to the words. How do I evaluate the quality of my finite life? How do I evaluate?
The whole time I was looking at, my first question was, about death and facing death, and the obvious corollary is, well, if we're going to die, then how good is our life? And if we're going to, you know, at the end of this whole thing, maybe you have a couple of days to lay on your deathbed, and maybe you don't. Maybe you need to be thinking about these things now. And it's as a juxtaposition, as a yin and yang, as a light and dark. how good has this been? And at the moment that it all goes out, it's probably better to have some thoughts about it rolling up too. Evaluate. I don't want to do some sort of, I don't want to do some sort of enumeration. I don't want it to be a quantification.
Why not?
So evaluate. I don't know. I think it seems to me there's probably no way to go out without some sort of longing. I don't know.
Probably. Although some people are longing for it to be over, like their body hurts, they're over it.
People approach that in severe pain in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Longing is part of life. It's a big part of life. How big? I think that desire is my word, is probably one of the most, I haven't facilitated it in probably 7 years. Desire is a voice that I used to facilitate with every group that I worked with for almost 10 years. And let me tell you, it's the voice that drives people.
It's a good one. We've done that.
It is. And that is what's driving you asking this question. It's what drives all of us to ask any of these questions during these sessions. But wanting to bring it back to Zen in these few minutes we have left, there's the mind that grasps for meaning. So I'm going to give you two options for voices, and maybe you can come up with your own, but we could do the voice of the one who's grasping for meaning, or we could do the voice of evaluating mind. Which strikes you as more relevant?
Say them again.
The one who's grasping for meaning or the evaluating mind?
Evaluating mind.
Allow me, please, to speak to the voice of the evaluating mind. And let's everybody go there. Who am I speaking to?
The evaluating mind.
And I believe that's who we've been speaking as to for the last 25 minutes. You know, I've been here. You've been here. Jaquetta's listening. Kristen's been listening. But really, it's been you. Now we're giving you a name is all. So how's it going for you?
With lots to consider.
Yeah.
Like
and you're not the concluding mind, are you? You're the evaluating mind. Were you trying to get Jaquetta's attention?
Yeah, I wanted her to look around in her immediate world.
What do you offer her? Why do you want to have her do that? What merit?
Awareness, consciousness, an acute sense of where she is right now, all the time, right now. Not before and not later, where she is right now.
Okay, then, as the evaluating mind, how good is her life, the quality of her finite life right now, in this moment?
Right at the second, it's great.
Okay. How about an hour ago?
Not too bad either.
Okay. So that's why it's the ultimate question. You know, how do I evaluate the quality of her life? Like you can never land on the answer. It's constantly changing. How good is it going to be at 5 o'clock tomorrow?
I don't know.
I don't know, right? But you can guess. Will she be at work?
5 a.m. or 5 p.m.?
P.m.
Work.
Work. And will she be hungry? Will she, you know, like, is she going to be sick of her person in the sitting next to her like she was the last 10 years? Like, you can evaluate based on past experience what's going to happen in the future. But going back to the fact that you're only concerned with right now, why is that?
It's the only thing that matters.
So you have evaluated that the only thing that matters is that you evaluate how things are going right now.
But that's not true.
Why not?
Because our past has an influence.
Sure.
In how well we think we are.
I think you, with the evaluating mind, can possibly evaluate that it would be optimal to just live in the moment and only evaluate the quality of her life based on this moment. But you're saying that, no, the past does matter, and, you know, that's what you have to go on. And you could probably give it a grade. You could give each year a grade. I know, as the evaluating mind, Kristen has this firm belief that 33 years old was the best year of her life, right? Like, I, as the evaluating mind, don't even remember what she was doing when she was 33 years old, but that's just her evaluation. That was my evaluation that year, and so I kind of hang on to that. You know, that was a 10 out of 10. You know, we, as the evaluating mind, are constantly looking at data, and her question is, how are you going to evaluate the quality of her finite life? How do you evaluate the quality of her life from now until her almost being 60 years old? What's your process?
It's complicated. It's not one thing.
Well, we had a conversation for quite some time about how do you evaluate it? You know, what is the thing that gives them meaning and purpose? What gives her meaning and purpose? We broke it down. You know, the whole spiritual ecstasis thing. Like, as the evaluating mind, can you, I mean, you could probably even put in a list, if you really were to take some time, all the times that she's had even a glimpse of that. And sometimes that's all it is a half-second glimpse, and it's like, oh my gosh, made the year a 10 out of 10, just once.
Right, to feel those things.
Yeah.
And they come in different forms.
They do. And what works for her when she was 10 versus what works for her, you know, when she didn't even have any concept or grasp of that, you know, just studying a butterfly versus what happens for her when she's 59 is very different. But the bigger question is, every voice has a wisdom and a delusion. Your wisdom is, she's not bored when you're around, that's for sure. Interesting. You're asking important questions. You're trying to figure out if she's leaving any stone unturned or anything left on the table. You know, time is short, running short. Like, I got to figure this out. Has she done enough? Is she enough? Has she learned enough? Has she had enough moments of ecstasis? This is important data to feed to her so that she can affect maybe her bucket list or change or, you know, do the things that she loves more, which is connect with people and put together a tent in the wind and all that. Like, more of those kinds of things need to happen. And there's the delusion in you, which is what?
Mm-hmm. That's everything. That joy and sustenance and wholeness are outside of herself in experience.
Or that meaning and purpose is found through a mathematical equation. step A, buy a Burning Man ticket. Step B, get yourself the Burning Man. Step 3, look for somebody on a windy day to set up a tent with. It's like you're very almost robotic and like stiff. You know, a spiritual experience, that ecstasis that she chases, only comes when you go away.
And these things just happen because you're there.
Yeah. She thinks
that makes it impossible to plan for.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you serve a purpose. You can make a plan to put her in a position so that these things can happen more often. But then she loses the thing that she's looking for if you stick around past a certain point. Or she never gets there, rather. Does that make sense?
No, I don't understand the last part. Why does she lose if...
It's kind of like, let's say somebody wants to win an Olympic gold medal, right? And that would give them a feeling like their life was justified, that they you know, birth, death, in between, won an Olympic gold medal. Like, that's the only thing, right? Evaluating mine, I just need to do that. And so next thing you know, you spark the desire to train and get the best training you can get on the US ski team, start racing, you know, get to the Olympics, all of that. You know, what role are you playing the day of the race?
Ah, okay.
Okay. Like, you have your use, but if she stays in you, she's stuck. And she's not going to have the experience she wants to have. She won't actually have a chance.
There's a place where I have to step back.
Yeah. And you
or
want her to
stop where I am and let everybody else go ahead. Okay.
Right. So you can be a real stuck place for her. But this is your chance to shine. We've put you on a stage. We've given you a week and prior to even this conversation, maybe months in her life that led to the questions in the first place. It's like you are very important part of this process of her maximizing her life. And you can also hold her back. She can get stuck in you. She can become overly identified with you. She can think that by you understanding more than what we've already understood, that somehow she'll have more of these experiences that she seeks, but it's actually not true past a certain point. Do you have anything else that you'd like to say or any advice that you'd like to give to Jaquetta before we do one last voice?
No, this is all very, very clear.
All right. Thank you. Allow me, please, to speak to the voice of the one who's free from evaluation. Or let's not even give it a name. Allow me, please, to speak to the voice of the opposite of you. Who am I speaking to?
I'm the opposite of that other guy.
Okay. And just be you. Notice if it's hard for the shift to be made. Notice if you're only here just a little bit. No longer evaluating, trying to understand, thinking. No more need to understand, no more thinking, no more evaluating. Just being. No mind. No thoughts. What do you have to offer, Jaquetta?
Daily life and all the stuff that comes with that. a fresh perspective every other second.
And the irony is
freedom from the yardstick.
What does
freedom
she want?
From measurement.
What does she want? What part of her wants to experience you more often?
A lot, to just be in whatever's happening next, whatever's happening now and right now.
So when the question gets asked by Jaquetta, how do I evaluate the quality of my finite life? Like, look at her. She's just asked that question. What do you say to her?
Her question about evaluation is about life after the fact. It's a tally at the end of the day. And I'm the beginning of the day and the day through. I'm all of it.
You're not an A++ or a B- or an F. Oh, my God.
Right.
What do you
There's
see
really
when she asks
There's really not even
that?
Time to apply a score to me because I'm right now.
Right. What advice do you have to give to Jaquetta?
You don't have to run to catch up with the ride. You're on the ride. And you don't have to wait for the end of the ride to check out how good it was.
She feels like she does have to.
And that's fine. Delta's always going to send you the email at the end of the trip and ask you how it went. But, and, you know, answer the email. Let them know. Let yourself know. But it's both. I'm aware that there's an awareness of me, but there's just me.
Right. And the Buddha calls it the middle way. So allow me, please, to speak to the voice of the conscious apex, the one that consciously includes and embraces the evaluating mind and the one who's free from the need to evaluate. We'll just call you the conscious apex. Who am I speaking to?
The conscious apex of evaluation and not.
Mm-hmm. Whenever we get to the middle way, it's always a Zen moment and a good place to finish. So I put my hands together. I bow to you. Thank you for engaging in consciousness practice with me today. And this is the last of our calls, and I would normally just say bye, you know, see you next week, but we'll offer these again. I hope that you sign up again. I think they've been really profound, really interesting. The questions that have been submitted were great. And does anybody have any last thing they want to ask before we say goodbye till next time? Okay, then I hope to talk to you all again soon. Great job, everybody.
Thank you, Kristen. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kristen.
Good night, everyone.
All right, good night.